All right, I got Ryan Bush on the show, best-selling author of Design the Mind and soon-to-be best-selling author of Become Who You Are. Ryan, welcome to the show, brother.
Thanks, Joel. I'm happy to be here.
All right, let's start things off right away. You invented a term called psychotecture, which is kind of like biohacking the mind. I'm obviously a big biohacker and health nut. What the heck do you mean by this? You talk about this concept, psychotecture, or like biohacking the mind. I'm a big biohacker, a big health nut. What the heck do you mean by psychotecture?
Yeah, so psychotecture is a term I coined in my first book. The subtitle of the book's called The Principles of Psychotecture. And so I had always had this vision of like a space, a community, a movement that kind of treated the mind the same way that we see in like fitness and nutrition nuts, where you're kind of optimizing all the nuts and bolts and trying to find ways to just make improvements. It's not deficiency or illness focused like we see in a lot of mental health space, where it's this very serious, sterile thing. It's very focused on positive growth and optimization. I've compared it to like trying to build a developers community, like software developers, where we've got forums and people saying, how do I make this tweak to this emotion or change this belief or habit? And I've kind of built a community around that online already. But essentially, psychotecture is about going into the individual psychological habits in your mind, whether that's your beliefs, your emotional reactions, your behaviors, and saying, how can I tweak and optimize this this experience I'm having? How can I change the individual algorithms, the input-output relationships in my mind, and design and change that so it works with me instead of against me? And so that's what I really explore throughout my work, but particularly in that first book, Designing the Mind.
Gotcha. In your new latest book, you talk about happiness a lot, and there's actually like this formula you talk about happiness. What do you think, after doing all your research and bringing in all the different works of art, Seligman and Nietzsche and all these people, what have you dissolved or distilled down? Like, this is the equation.
All right. So here's the way I introduce it to start. If you imagine there's a chessboard sitting in front of you, and this two-dimensional chessboard has kind of these two axes. One is pleasure and pain, the kind of x-axis, and one is loss and gain, the y-axis. So what I argue is that essentially this is the map that most of us are using to navigate our lives and our happiness. We're trying to, you know, get some pleasure here, sacrifice pleasure to make some long-term gain in our circumstances there. And it's all this kind of balance of these simple factors. Now, this is great a lot of the time, but sometimes we find problems with it. We'll have something that happens in our lives that looks like a total gain on paper, and yet we don't feel any happier. And we kind of shrug and say, why didn't that work? Or we'll have this loss that we think is going to ruin our lives, and we end up saying it's the best thing that ever happened to me. So if that was the right map for us to be navigating our lives with, you would think it would always map onto our experience, but very often it fails to do so. Lottery winners and paraplegics, for example, a year after their respective incidents, they've been found to have the same levels of happiness before. So clearly, having very good things happen to you in your life and your circumstances doesn't necessarily make you happy, and having seemingly bad things doesn't necessarily make you happy. So the question is, what is it? What makes us deeply fulfilled? What's that hidden factor? So if you imagine taking this chessboard and pulling mountains and valleys and basically turning it into a three-dimensional chessboard, this third dimension is what I argue is kind of hidden under the surface, pulling the strings of our happiness, even when we think the things that we're pursuing in our lives are really what's making us happy, right? And so the question is, what is this third dimension? What are the valleys? What are the mountains? And I use the term virtue for this, but virtue has this kind of outdated connotation. It comes across as this kind of preachy moral purity thing. The ancient Greeks used it in a much more colorful, interesting way. And in many ways, I think it refers to basically any signature strength that you have, any individual positive trait that you would admire in someone else. When you bring that out and you observe yourself taking these actions, bringing these strengths out into the world, that's when you actually climb up those mountains and get happier, right? And so we're constantly kind of going around thinking that these external things happening to us are really responsible for happiness when they're only really sort of a means to an end. And so sometimes we change our circumstances. I mean, you can truly, you can win the lottery and then, you know, use that wealth in a way that brings out more of your strengths, and it will make you happier. You know, if you quit a mindless job and you, you know, become an angel investor or start an organization of your own, I mean, you could put yourself into a much better place in terms of bringing out your personal virtues and becoming a person you admire more yourself. Or you could also do the opposite and basically use that money to quit the job that was previously using your strengths. You could, you know, throw all the money away on drugs and strippers and whatever, and essentially bring yourself down in this Z dimension. And you'd wonder, you know, I had the best thing in the world happen to me. Why am I not happier? And so this three-dimensional map is the sort of the centerpiece of this argument I make. In this part two of the book, I explore the theory behind it, why our happiness works this way, everything from evolutionary psychology to neuroscience. But this is the new map that I essentially want to give people. I want them to be able to navigate their lives in three dimensions and see that, you know, the things they're doing in their lives really are promoting deeper well-being beyond just external gain.
Yeah, that was almost some of the one of the concepts I thought I got from the book, and it was this idea of, okay, if we're not motivated by pain and pleasure, which there's some motivation there, obviously, or gain and loss, then it sounds like we should really be prioritizing virtues. So how the heck do we do that? How do we find good virtues that are like, oh, these are like the winning virtues? If we do these, most likely we will build that three-dimensional model in a quote unquote what the world would say, hey, you're successful.
Yeah, yeah. And it's important to note that we are very motivated by pleasure and gain, actually more so than this hidden dimension of virtue I'm talking about. And that's why it can be so tricky, is that these things are enticing, they are motivating, but they don't actually deliver like we often expect them to. And this is what really delivers. So we need to be paying very careful attention to it. Now, as for how to do it, I think there are a lot of ways to kind of break this down, a lot of exercises you can do to really get in touch with these strengths, these values that you have and admire in others, and how to integrate them into your life. So one of these is simply to observe the people that you admire most in your life, people around you, people in history, people in, you know, fictional TV shows, whatever it is, creating a really extensive list of these people and writing down what specific traits do I admire most about these people, and getting that to a point where you can say, okay, this captures everything that I really care about. This is everything that I want to become myself and that I would admire myself for and be proud of. And taking this as a kind of starting point for what you're going to do next, what your next step in your life is, instead of just looking at that new job and saying, oh, how does the salary compare, right? Saying, how will this enable me to bring out more of these admirable traits than my current job or where I'm at right now? So that's one exercise you can do. Another, there are a lot of sort of strengths tests online. Martin Seligman's signature strength test is a really good one that will basically tell you, here are your top five signature strengths, right? And very often focusing on the things we're already good at, doubling down on that will pay off more than just focusing on our weaknesses or the things we're mediocre at. And so really identifying those things that you're already good at. You can do this also by asking people around you, people in your life who have known you since you were a kid, saying, what am I good at? What do you think I've always thrived at? And very often they will surprise you in this kind of thing. So these are a couple ways. I talk about a lot more methods in the book, particularly for people who are depressed, because I basically argue that depression is a caused by identity failure. Essentially, if you are depressed, you are not seeing evidence of those virtues. And your brain that was basically built to monitor you all the time and look for these strengths in your behavior isn't able to find those traits. And so getting yourself to a place where you can see those virtues and start to elevate your view of yourself, it's kind of the first step to getting out of that vicious cycle too.
Yeah, you mentioned that this book is the opposite of depression. Were you someone that battled depression in the past, or what? I've seen you kind of mention that layer of depression and anxiety over and over again. Was that something that occurred in your life, and then using some of this model, did that help you?
Yeah. So in some ways it was, you know, kind of a battle with depression for me for the over the course of about a year, that led me to this theory, because I had been kind of examining all these different puzzle pieces and trying to figure out how they fit together for like decades now. And they hadn't quite clicked together yet. And then I, you know, had an experience where kind of for the first time in my life, my self-esteem started going down. My mood started getting lower. I started losing interest in the activities I had always been interested in. And I think I basically became mildly to moderately depressed. And it was only after coming out of this that I started to say, oh, this is how it works. This is how all these puzzle pieces fit together. You know, I was at a place where I was, my job had gradually transformed into this kind of monotonous job doing things I wasn't very good at. I was doing, you know, I started out doing really creative kind of visionary design work, and it had gradually transformed into tedious engineering drafts that I was really bad at, frankly. I had, you know, people in my life who were causing me to question some of my interpersonal virtues. I was dealing with like a neurodivergent diagnosis and further questioning these things. And it caused, for a period of maybe 9 months, for my view of myself to decline, my perception of my own virtues to get lower, and my mood went down just along with it like clockwork. And it allowed me to connect a lot of dots that, oh, depression isn't just a, you know, serotonin deficiency or something like that. It very deeply relates to our view of ourselves and our own strengths. And the opposite of depression, I use the term that was used by the ancient Greeks, eudaimonia. Interestingly enough, 2,000 years ago, they had a very strong intuition themselves that the highest peak of well-being was deeply tied to virtue, and that they basically, all these philosophies from Aristotle to the Stoics to Plato, they all kind of agreed, like, the more virtue you bring into your behaviors, the happier you are. Even like, you know, Socrates chose to be executed when he could have escaped because he didn't want to live a life where he didn't approve of himself and see himself demonstrating these traits. And so you can see this in a lot of these ancient thinkers, and it lines up very well with modern research. I mean, I have proposed that eudaimonia is the opposite end of the spectrum to clinical depression. We haven't really thought about it that way, but I think this mechanism in our brain that monitors us and kind of, you know, that self-critical monologue in your head is basically elevating and lowering your mood according to its evaluations of you.
So you think for when it comes to depression, the root cause of depression is identity.
Yes. Yes.
Or lack of identity. Like, I don't know who I really am. And so when I go out in the world, like, I don't have a GPS. I don't know my coordinates. I don't know really where I'm going. I don't know how I'm being. I don't even know how to be my higher self because I don't even know what that is. Is that kind of right?
Yeah, that's a big part of it. I mean, I think if you just don't have a strong sense of identity, you might become like mildly depressed. But what we see in people who are severely depressed is that they have a very strong negative identity. So they often see themselves as incompetent, unlovable, worthless. Of course, it's this very distorted belief system, but pretty much invariably, people who are depressed have a broken identity. They have a very negative view of themselves. And I think we find the opposite in people who are deeply fulfilled. They have a very positive view of themselves, not a narcissistic, overly kind of self-oriented view, but they, you know, if you ask them, they will tell you they have a very positive view of their own strengths. They're bringing them out every day in their lives, right? This is a kind of a core distinction that I think we need to be focusing on more. You know, cognitive behavioral therapy basically says if you can change the beliefs behind your emotions, you'll change the emotions along with them. And I think this is partly right. I also think sometimes our beliefs are right, and it's our behaviors that aren't lining up with our ideals. So a lot of times when people are depressed, they get trapped in this vicious cycle where they're not motivated, so they aren't leaving the house and doing things. As a result, they're not giving their brain evidence that they really are good at these things, and that's dropping their mood and their motivation further. And so finding a way to take those behaviors that make you proud of yourself, even little by little, to sort of climb your way out of that vicious cycle is one of the best ways of doing it. And that's called behavioral activation in CBT.
Gotcha. How do you differentiate between values and virtues? Because when I was reading the book, I kept thinking, these to me sound like values, and I'm a big value person. Like a lot of them in my coaching, I even ask people, like, what are your top five values? Who do you say that you are, or who do you aspire to be? But you make a little bit of a distinction in the book, and I'm still a little confused on that. So how do you distinguish between those nuances?
Yeah, so they're very closely tied together, but we use the term virtues when we're talking about the behaviors that we're bringing out as the individual actors ourselves. And we use the term values when we're observing someone else's actions. And so very often it's our own values that are evaluating our virtues, right? So they're closely related. You could think of one as kind of the giving end and one as the receiving end. You want your virtues and your behaviors to line up with your values and your perceptions. And so you can often use the terms interchangeably. We can talk about virtues that we observe cross-culturally. You know, Martin Seligman has found like 24 virtues that every culture seems to value. And so that's kind of the relationship. You can use them the same, but there is a kind of meaningful distinction once you get into the weeds.
In your book too, you mentioned there was a part in the book, and I underlined it. I don't know if I'm getting it right, but you said something about virtues being created by society, by your tribe, by like your environment can shape these virtues. Is that right? Am I getting kind of that right?
Yeah. So what I've argued is that if you think about how certain organisms evolved, I mean, certain, like, if you look at the peacock, for example, Darwin famously was really disturbed by the peacock's tail because initially his theory didn't really account for it. He was saying, you know, this huge elaborate tail on this peacock's back is like a target for predators. It's, you know, really costly to grow a tail like that. It takes more energy, right? It should be bad for survival. Why do peacocks have these beautiful, elaborate tails? And what he eventually pieced together is that, you know, these are attractive in many ways because they aren't good for fitness, because it takes a very fit peacock to be able to pull off a tail like that. And so it serves as a fitness indicator for mates. And as a result, it starts to be selected by mates. And so what I argue is that the reason why human virtues came about, even though they aren't visible in the same way as a peacock's tail, they're kind of like the elaborate plumage of our brains, right? These virtues like creative intelligence and generosity, they came about through a very similar mechanism. This is something that I, you know, originally picked up from Jeffrey Miller, who's an evolutionary psychologist, and I've kind of built on it. But essentially, the reason why we value the things we do, I think, is because our social tribes have come to value these things, and it becomes a selective factor in our relationships. And so does that mean that we should basically just turn ourselves into whatever people around us want us to be? I don't think so, because I think our brain has a built-in mechanism that evolved along with these virtues and values to evaluate us ourselves, to be constantly perceiving us even when the people around us aren't sending us clear signals. And as a result, I think we should be trying to prove our virtues to our own brains every day. We should be taking the actions that we would approve of, even if no one around us is watching, right? And this will turn us into the kind of person that we admire and will sort of bring about that deeper well-being over time.
Yeah, and I was thinking, okay, if happiness is equated now to virtues, but then our environment, our tribe, our society shapes these virtues, like just our microcosm environment. Then I'm thinking, oh my God, what chance do we have, Ryan? Like, if, you know what I mean? Like, or right. or even better, if I'm reading your book and I'm like, okay, well, you know, I get that. Man, how do I get, what if the virtues in my environment that I'm being bombarded by daily are not good virtues? They're not virtuous at all. How do I realize that and step out of that? Have you seen any success in that, or have you seen what people could do to get out of maybe, I mean, I don't know, I guess there wouldn't be such a thing as it'd be an oxymoron to call it problematic virtues, but do you know what I mean? Where just the environment is shaping us not for success.
Yeah, I think we could speak about proxy virtues. So we have things like profitability that I don't think we evolved to value, right? There was no such thing as profit in our ancestors' world, but it's kind of what everything is centered around in society. So it's not a real virtue. It's kind of a fake virtue, but we get conditioned to value this more than we should. And so I think, you know, this happens in varying degrees through every culture. Every culture kind of selects certain virtues and excludes the others. And I think despite what our cultures do and how they evolve over time, there is a common sort of universal core that can be found if we listen very carefully to our own deeper impulses. If we, I sometimes say, take a philosophical wrecking ball to your cultural beliefs and values and figure out what keeps standing underneath it all. What are those core values that are deeper than that? And so I think in a lot of ways, it's about asking yourself the right questions. I developed a deck of introspection cards called Mindsight that's basically like 81 cards meant to help you get to know yourself and shed some of the cultural baggage that you've inherited. And I think the more you introspect, the more you inquire about yourself and your philosophical views and your values, the more clear of a view you get of who you actually should become as opposed to who your culture, your parents, your friends want you to become, because those are not always going to be the same thing.
Yeah. Okay. Awesome. I love that. Talk about the default mode network. You know, you dedicated an entire chapter in your book to it. I've heard a lot of other, you know, psychiatrists and other health enthusiasts talk about this default mode network and that it's always running in the background. It can be positive. It can be negative. So talk about that and why you felt it's such an important part to develop a whole chapter or devote a whole chapter in the book to it.
Yeah, I love it. I don't get to talk about this part enough. So awesome. The default mode network, I've been hearing more and more about it over the years. A lot of people have argued that it's like the neurological center of the self or the ego or whatever. And I sort of assumed that was more of a like exaggerated fad or whatever that culture was attributing to this network. But the more I studied it, the more I found that this is really true. I mean, So for background, the default mode network is a network of brain regions that are basically active at all times in our brains when we aren't engaged in another activity. And so if you are just sitting there, your default mode network is lighting up. And if someone gives you a task and says, you know, work on this math problem, then the default mode network stops and focuses on the task. But we spend a lot of our waking lives basically running a program in this network. And when we've studied it, what we find is that it corresponds very closely to self-referential thinking. A lot of people say daydreaming, but it's very often self-oriented, status-oriented daydreaming. We're thinking about ourselves, how we line up to our values, how other people perceive us, right? And ultimately, I think this is what maps on to that self-critical monologue that a lot of people have going in their minds, constantly criticizing themselves and saying you're not good enough. I think this is what the default mode network is doing, to constantly evaluate us, constantly look at those traits that we admire, those virtues, and say, how are you stacking up? Okay, and so this can be a very bad thing. And we see that people who are depressed have a really distorted kind of activity and functional connectivity in the default mode network. We see that people who meditate religiously, you know, they have a very quieted activity in the default mode network. And psychedelics like psilocybin seem to disrupt activity and change connections in this network. So there's something very interesting going on in this network. And I've come to the conclusion that this is the source of a mechanism in our brain. You could call it the ego in spiritual circles. You could call it, the sociometer, which has been proposed by evolutionary psychologists as a mechanism for self-esteem. But ultimately, this is one system in the brain that is kind of like a central focus in our minds that is meant to regulate our moods. And so this is where people haven't entirely connected the dots, but I think it makes a lot of sense and it lines up with, there's a lot of connection between the default mode network and serotonin, which has been closely linked to well-being, positive emotions, and depression. And so really, I think what the default mode network is doing is it's observing us, it's observing our behaviors, and it's saying, how socially approvable are we? right? If it concludes that we're not highly socially approvable, it's going to put us in a mood that makes us want to take behaviors that won't hurt our social status. And so it'll cause us to socially withdraw. It'll cause us to become more socially risk averse. So we aren't taking big social risks and really putting ourselves out there. This is what we see in depression. But if it does evaluate us positively and it does find, oh, I really, you know, think this person is admirable, I think this person is likely to be approved by their social tribe, then it's going to upregulate our mood and induce behaviors that will cause us to put ourselves out there and really, you know, exploit that social approval at this moment. And so basically, this mechanism is regulating our moods up and down, all the way down to the bottom extreme of depression and the top extreme of eudaimonia.
Yeah. Wow, there's so much new stuff coming out with that every day. It's fascinating. It's fascinating stuff. You know, I was thinking, you know, you wrote in the book, and this kind of ties in with the default mode network, because you're talking about this approval of self, right? When the and when we have this approval of ourselves, then we show up in the world better, happier, let's say, right? Not depressed. But in the book, you talk about in the self-appraisal systems and how a lot of us have done this through maybe mantras, affirmations. And you said that's not the way to go, because that, you said, we'll send ourselves the message that our values and strengths don't matter. Talk about that, because I know a lot of people, including myself, who have done affirmations and I am successful, I am wealthy, I am this, or other mantras. You know, there's obviously TM, they use mantras, which is a little bit different. But talk about why you think like that's an absolute way for people to fail if they're trying to become more successful, achieve more, or just be happy.
Your self-approval is linked to your actions and the traits that you are taking at any given time. Right? Just telling yourself that you are good at something, that you're likable, that you're competent, in and of itself, that doesn't change your actual behaviors. So you're sort of trying to distort your own view of yourself. And I think your brain is a little smarter than this. I think a part of your brain knows that you're doing that, that you didn't really earn that self-approval. And this is a lot of what's been found. You know, back in the 90s, self-esteem was all the rage, right? All the schools and programs were trying to find a way to inflate children's self-esteem. And while self-esteem is crucial, what we find is that it really has to be earned. If you just say nice things to people and tell them they're the best, or tell yourself that you're the best, a part of your brain doesn't really buy it. And so it doesn't actually increase all these positive outcomes. It doesn't actually increase happiness if you aren't really demonstrating those strengths in your life, in your actions. You're not really going to be able to trick your brain. And so I think there could be a place. The evidence is a little shaky on affirmations, but I think there could be a place for just giving yourself that initial confidence that will then cause you to go out there and actually do things, which will then increase your self-esteem and well-being. But just by itself, telling yourself, I am really creative, even though you aren't doing anything creative in your life every day, I don't think that's going to do a whole lot. And so I think it's the wrong approach to focus on affirmations and just telling yourself words. And the right approach is to go out and prove it to yourself as much a part of your daily schedule as you can.
It sounds like you're saying action is the antidote.
Absolutely. Yeah. And there's a lot of, I mean, Goethe has a great quote in the book, which is like, if you want to, you know, prove yourself, never by words, but by actions, never by thoughts, but by actions. And there's a lot of evidence for this too. I mean, in cognitive behavioral therapy, there's more support for the idea that creating this daily activity schedule and building more of this virtue into your life is more effective than just thinking and changing your thoughts. It's best to do them in tandem. It's best to correct cognitive distortions and go out there and take action. But there's a lot of support for just this behavioral activation component and actually proving it to yourself instead of just thinking about it and talking about it. So absolutely.
Yeah. Action. Love that. Talk about best advice for self-becoming. You know, this whole book is about becoming who you are. And I think a lot of us, you know, I'm 41 and a lot of us go through the midlife crisis and, you know, there's identity, back to identity. We are always asking ourselves, like, who am I? Am I really living my true purpose? With, you know, you start asking yourself these questions, the, again, quote unquote, midlife crisis. And you've got the, again, you got this whole book talking about, you know, virtues, and we've gone through all these different other things that we've talked, frameworks that we've talked about. But so what do you think then? What's the key, or people need to start getting in action right now if they're asking themselves, who am I and how, who do I want to become? What's your advice?
Yeah. So if we're looking at sort of the midlife crisis range, you know, you're maybe not at the bottom, you're not super depressed, but you are a little lost and you're not sure what to go next. I encourage people to focus on their virtue portfolio and their virtue domains. So what this means is your portfolio is, it's kind of like, you know, investment. You have these virtues that you have sort of proven to yourself throughout your life, I'm really good at these things. You want to craft this portfolio and find a way to maximize it. And so you'll very often find that you could even monitor like your own virtues and how much you're bringing them out in your life on like a stock chart and see that your overall well-being corresponds. When you're getting less happy, it's like a market crash where your virtues aren't coming out. And when you're really happy, it's like a boom. And so crafting and nurturing this portfolio and making it a major part of how you make decisions in your life is a huge part of this. Figuring out what you're really good at and what you admire and saying, how can I bring this into my work, my relationships, my communities, right? This is what I call virtue domains. And so very often work is one of these. We can bring certain traits into our work. I personally really pride myself on ingenuity, creativity, and rationality. And a lot of these come out primarily through my work. But I also pride myself on my charm and sense of humor and love and these things. And that comes out in my relationships. If you are missing one of these core domains, you're missing a huge opportunity to bring out a lot of those strengths. Now, what I have done in the last few years is kind of a step beyond that, which is, you know, I went from having a job that allowed me to bring out some of these traits and, you know, relationships and communities to building a business where I basically asked myself, how can I combine all 12 of these things that I'm good at and passionate about? And I built Designing the Mind, wrote this book that kicked off this whole community, essentially. And it's provided me with the ultimate vessel for bringing out these things I'm good at every day. And so asking yourself, not only how can I, you know, take actions every day that will bring out all these, you know, 10, 20 different virtues, saying, how can I combine them into one place? And when you identify that way of combining them, you know, it will just feel like magical. It'll feel like this is what I have to do. This is what I was meant to do. And that is one of the ultimate vessels for bringing out those strengths. So if you can come up with a way, whether it's starting a business or an organization or something like that, to bring it all together, that is a beautiful thing. And it's all too rare in this world. Very few people are able to find a place where they're able to combine everything that they're good at. When I think about the anti-Mindform is the kind of community I've built around all this. The anti-Mindform would be me having to like play basketball and like make small talk with people all day. And that would be terrible. Like it's not just that we are bad at things across the board, even though sometimes we feel that way. It's that we haven't crafted that our lives to channel our strengths and minimize our weaknesses. And so that's one of the things I advise. If you're in that midlife crisis, you're not miserable, but you're not super deeply fulfilled either. Ask yourself how you can build that vessel in your life.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I like that. And that's kind of the idea, like you just said. It's like, if here's my perfect life, And I, if I could dream of whatever that might look like, what are the values, what are the virtues that I would be embodying on a daily basis? You start writing them down, you get some clarity there. It's like, oh, then it's going to lead you. The more you can be in, I don't know. And I'm actually curious for you, when you think of virtues, do you try to keep it to about 5 virtues, or does, because, you know, imagine you have like 10 different virtues and you're like, oh man, I there's a lot of buckets that I'm trying to live up to in my life. That's a lot. Or do you try to kind of keep it to 3 to 5, or what do you think?
There are a lot of different ways you could do it. I would say don't put all your eggs in one basket. Don't just have one virtue, because then, you know, if something happens to affect your ability to bring that out, that's your whole portfolio is crashing, right? And so it's good to diversify. 3 to 5 is great. I'm not saying you can't bring in 10 or 15, but kind of work your way up gradually. See if you can put a few of them together and get a really robust foundation for it. But I like to emphasize that, you know, virtues aren't just sort of moral virtues. I think it includes that. But your creativity, your sense of humor, basically anything that people admire about others and say that's a good trait to have, that's something you can include. And Nietzsche actually said, if you have a virtue, that's your virtue and no one else's. And so these really may be as unique as our fingerprints, right? We may all have our own combination of strengths that are slightly different from anyone else on the planet. And so asking, what is it that I could do that no one else on the planet could do? I know that sounds like a very high bar, but truthfully, there is something out there that's, it's not about being the best, it's about being the only. It's about finding a way to be the most you that you can. And so I think finding those handful of traits that are unique to you, and everyone has them, this is the way forward.
Yeah. And also, even you brought up a great point with the whole midlife crisis thing. If you're not living to, you believe, your highest purpose and who you want to become, then just doing a simple life audit, it almost sounded like you're doing, like, here's the categories that I would absolutely love. But now that I've wrote them all out, I'm living like a one in each of these, let's say out of 10, I'm living like a one out of 10. You're going to get some really good clarity on being like, man, this area needs to get bumped up and this area I'm putting too much effort in. So to your point, I really like that idea. That's a great framework for anybody who's looking for that, you know, trying to become who they really truly desire to be.
Yeah, and it's tempting to ignore this sometimes. We can find ourselves in golden handcuffs where we're in a cushy, comfortable job, and we're, you know, getting paid well, we're comfortable, we're not being challenged. Our brains get lazy. We try to sort of lock ourselves into these spaces, but you are absolutely going to be more fulfilled if you break out of that comfortable thing and find a way to sort of follow this internal compass, even though, yeah, it's hard. And it's hard when society tells you, like, you're doing what society approves of, but ultimately it's not what you yourself approve of. And that, I think, is a big part of this midlife crisis thing. I think, you know, it's not something that happens to everyone in the middle of their life, but if you aren't living the way that you are proud of, and you've just modeled a life that's sort of good on paper according to society, but doesn't connect to your ideals, then you might have a crisis. And I think that could be a really great thing for you long term if you do have that crisis in that scenario.
Yeah. Yeah. Good stuff. You know, you got the book that just dropped. Any other exciting projects that you're working on or getting ready for that you're excited about?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So Mindform is, it's currently an online community. So I've got, you know, you have to apply to join, but it's this really incredible philosophical personal growth community. But I want to do much bigger things with Mindform. I'm working on designing really custom software that will be almost like a Duolingo for the mind in terms of like a gamified training experience that'll teach you how to use these tools. I want to build brick and mortar Mindform centers at some point where you almost have like the mental equivalent of a fitness gym you can be a member of. So I've got very big projects after this, but a big part of what this book launch is hopefully going to do is enable a lot of this stuff and bring in a bigger audience. And so can make some really interesting things happen through that. But I've always got lots of projects on this front. And I've just in the last 3 years, it's kind of amazing to me, but I've written 2.5 books, 2 online programs, 2 physical products, and a membership community. So we're doing big things fast. Would love to have any of your listeners join on board if it sounds like something they're into.
Yeah, no, it's been really neat to just see your growth in the last, like you said, 2 years. It's you've put out a lot, and a lot of people are receptive. They're into it, and that's exciting. You're creating a movement, man. So it's really neat.
That's the goal.
Yeah, I wanted to wrap some things up and just ask you a couple final round questions. But before I do, just anything that I didn't ask you that you wish I had.
No, this has been a really great conversation. We covered a lot of ground here, so I like it.
Yeah, awesome. I mean, I'm a big reader, man. I'm curious for you. Obviously, you are too. I mean, you just look at all the references you put in your books. What are, if there were like a top 1 to 3 books that had a huge impact on your life, what would you tell people? Go out and read these books. It'll probably change your life.
That is tough. I actually have three right here. One of them is Marcus Aurelius Meditations, incredible tools for, improving your thinking and your emotions. I've got the Tao Te Ching, Lao Tzu from, ancient Taoism, very valuable. I've got some Nietzsche, Beyond Good and Evil. I also think Abraham Maslow, highly underestimated thinker. People think he's just kind of the pyramid hierarchy of motivations guy, but he had a brilliant vision for self-actualization and for bringing about better minds and better people and a better society. So, Toward a Psychology of Being by him, The Farther Reaches of Human Nature. These are incredible books that I've gotten a ton out of. I actually have a, if you go to Designing the Mind on Goodreads, I have about 500 books that I highly recommend. And so, you can get a whole list there. I also have a little toolkit that has about maybe 50 books that I really recommend. You can get that at designingthemind.org/psychitecture, and it's got some other good stuff that you get for free too. So.
Very cool. A guy like you, really who understands self-development at a high level, go-getter, achiever, what are some rituals or practices or things that you do on a regular basis?
Yeah, this is a good question. So I've sort of gone through the whole like self-help, personal improvement, habits phase in my life where I had like I was trying to stack like 20 habits in my morning routine. And what I've found is I really prefer what you might call trigger-based habits. And this is something where when I have a certain kind of thought, I try to build a either another hot thought or a certain behavior like writing it down in a journal app based on that thought. And so on any given day, I've got these, kind of triggers going off in my brain saying, oh, I just had like a pessimistic thought. How do I approach that? What do I do about that? Do I write this down in kind of a cognitive log? Do I try to replace it with this other thought? And so I've pretty much gotten to where, aside from like the basic hygiene things, I don't have a lot that I do every day. I work out regularly. I take a shower in the morning, brush my teeth, that kind of thing. But I don't have like the seven like cold shower meditation, like all the typical self-help things. And I've found that really building good systems that are sort of activated by certain psychological triggers have been the most helpful thing for me.
Do you review your virtues on a regular basis? Is that something that you like to look at daily then, in a sense of like, oh yeah, that's what I'm aiming for every day?
I actually at one point had a mission statement that I would read out loud to myself every day. And what I found is anytime you have something like that you do every day, it kind of becomes a chore and it loses its power after a couple months. So I like to revisit my sort of virtues list and make changes every like 3 years or so. And I will, obviously check back in with it periodically throughout. But it's always on my mind. I'm always conscious of it as I'm making decisions. I have the option of like hiring a team right now and becoming basically a manager, and I don't think that would bring out my greatest strengths. So I'm staying solo for the time being, even though it might speed things up to build this whole team. I want to really make sure I'm bringing out my strengths the best I can, and I think I'm doing that. The way I'm doing it now is the best way to do that. So it's a big part of my considerations.
Yeah, I love that insight because so often that's all we're hearing right now is go, 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 do more cold plunges, do more gratitude journaling, then you'll be successful. And so it's always neat to see how other high performers are doing things and saying, listen, you can be just as successful or do whatever. You don't need to do that. So I really value just that insight that and kind of your path too, because I go down the self-development path myself and just go, go, go. And oh, this is the new thing I got to add. Now my morning habit's taking me 2 hours. It used to only take me one. So it's nice.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's nice to hear that what other people are doing. That's why I asked that question. Man, amazing stuff, Ryan. Everything that you're up to, really excited. Last but not least, just kind of share with everybody where they can find you, connect with you, learn more about what you're doing.
Yeah, so that designingthemind.org/psychitecture is a great link to go to get a couple free books and join the email list. I send out a psychitect email every Saturday, so it's a great place to go. But also, the new book will be available for pre-order very soon, probably by the time this airs, and you'll be able to find that you know, pretty much anywhere online, possibly in bookstores. And and I've got a bunch of like bonus stuff I'll give you if you pre-order. So be sure to send me that receipt if you do, and I'll get you a lot of good stuff.
Awesome stuff. Ryan Bush, with the author of Become Who You Are. Appreciate you, brother. Thanks for being on the show.
Thanks for having me. Great conversation.